From the time she was a little girl, Melissa Phoebos recognized that keeping secrets about her life gave her a certain power over the people around her. When she was very young, the secrets were simple things. She'd take objects from her home, bury them in the yard, and then hide the very elaborate map she drew, pinpointing the locations of her treasure. Later, her secrets grew much darker. None of her family or friends knew that even as she was making straight A's as a college student in New York City, she was a heroin addict. Or that for 3 years during that same time period, she was working as a professional dominatrix in a Midtown Manhattan dungeon. We know all this about Melissa because 7 years ago, she wrote a book called Whip Smart, describing her hidden life. That might seem like a strange undertaking for someone who had cherished her secrecy and who had lived through experiences that other people might judge very harshly. But Melissa realized that writing about her life candidly was crucial to coming to terms with who she really is. Here's what she said about this in a TED Talk last year.
The art of personal writing is the art of revealing yourself, not as you wish to be seen by others, but as you actually are. You have to meet the gaze of your past self and ask her the questions that sometimes we spend our whole lives avoiding asking. And then you have to listen to her answers.
You'd think that having revealed her addiction and her work as a dominatrix, Melissa would have already spilled her darkest secrets. But it turns out she had even more troubling issues she knew would be even harder to confront openly. Her piercing need to be loved, to have her life affirmed by another human being. That's the subject of her new book, Abandon Me, Memoirs. It's a series of essays that focus largely on the obsessive 2-year love affair she had with a woman named Amaya. As Melissa and I sat down to talk, I asked her to talk about the dual meaning of the word abandon, which figures into her sense of aloneness, as well as her willingness to give herself completely to another person.
These are often my favorite concepts, my favorite words, sort of words that have that kind of polar quality. There's a lot of tension in it, because the two meanings of abandon, one is this sort of passive, I'm going to use the word trauma, though that feels sort of weighted. It's this angsty thing, someone leaving you, being left behind. It's not a desirable thing, right? And sometimes when I'm being flip, I say that the book is about my abandonment issues, which is a term we're all familiar with. But the other definition of abandon has a similar meaning in a literal way, but a totally different connotation, where to abandon yourself to something suggests agency. It suggests a pleasurable kind of yielding. We abandon ourselves to things that we feel passionate about, right? There's a joyful connotation to it. And so for me, I think at the crux of this book is sort of experiences that can move from one pole of that word's definition to the other one. And maybe a supposition that the first definition can be answered in some way by the second.
So I'd like to talk about this on two different tracks, if we could. One of them is you as a writer writing your experiences, and then talk about the experiences themselves and what perhaps we might learn from your experiences.
Before you go on, can I just thank you for making that differentiation? As a personal essayist and a memoirist, I think I am often having to sort of teach people the difference between my life experience and the work that I made out of it. So I just want to thank you for doing that.
No, but even as you say that, though, you say something really important in the book. You say, even when we write our own stories, there's no place to hide. You hide nothing in this book that we can determine.
Or so it appears, yes.
Yeah, so it appears. That's right.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely reveal as much as I can, certainly much, much more than I could in person. You know, in many ways, I think my writing practice is a way of sort of sublimating my own sort of competing instincts for secrecy and hiding, but also closeness and connection and confession even. You know, I think that's where intimacy in relationships comes from. I think it's how we sort of free ourselves from our pasts or our inner conflicts is by sharing them. It's how we feel known, right? It is the cure for aloneness or loneliness.
You just said an important thing, though. Mm-hmm. You write in here things that you cannot say out loud.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, honestly, many of the first times I've spoken aloud about these subjects has been into a microphone or to an audience at a Q&A at a reading, because when I write, I'm just having a conversation with myself. You know, it sort of becomes this like middleman where I can practice putting words to the things that most scare me. And then I publish the book, and then suddenly there are people asking me about it, and I'm in a conversation saying it aloud for the first time. It's an interesting way to sort of come out.
There can be pain in writing so candidly about your life. When you wrote Whip Smart, mm-hmm. you tell a story about a reunion kind of meal, mm-hmm. brunch, I think mm-hmm. you say, with your father, your stepfather, mm-hmm. the sea captain in mm-hmm. your life, who we'll talk about a little bit more. Mm-hmm. He saw that brunch as a coming together of two people who had been somewhat estranged from one another, mm-hmm. And so he came away from that brunch feeling just great that mm-hmm. you'd reconnected. Mm-hmm. And then he read the way you described it in the book. Tell us about
that.
That's
right. That was one of the more painful experiences of publishing that book, because I think, you know, for me to write about my most personal, vulnerable, harrowing experiences is difficult in its own way. I have to confront a sort of larger truth of my own experience. I have to often annihilate a version of my own story that I've created that makes it more comfortable for me to live with it. But it also implicates other people in the sense that I have to sometimes destroy their narratives of what happened in the past. And that was true for my father. It was something I didn't foresee when I was writing the book necessarily, but I basically took some of his happy memories and just set them on fire.
What did you say about that brunch compared
that
to what
I
he
had
said?
I had been on sort of a drug binge, and I was really sick, and I was really sort of scraping along the bottom of that particular experience. This is when I was a dominatrix and a heroin addict, and I was going to great lengths to hide the gravity of my situation from other people. And so he had no idea. I was actively hiding it from him. But then I sent him this book, and suddenly I was destroying some of his most precious memories.
Are there things in Abandon Me that you're worried people who know you and care about you are going to read and have a difficult response to?
Oh, I've already confronted those experiences.
Tell us about that.
It's been 7 years since my first book came out, and with Whip Smart, I had no reference for how the book was going to affect the people closest to me. But this time around, I had a better sense of it. And this time around, I was also 7 years older. I'd been in therapy for many more years, and I was much more capable of having those conversations before the book was published. And so after I finished the editorial process, but before it went to print, I sent the book to every member of my immediate family. And I said to them, there are going to be some things in here that are hard to read, that you might disagree with, that you might want to correct. And I'm interested in your feedback. I can't make any promises, but I'll do the best I can do. And everybody had feedback. And I had, you know, with my mother, my father, and my brother, I had three of the most intimate, challenging, deep conversations that I'd ever had with another person, because, you know, what I do in writing is name things and have conversations with myself that I am terrified to have with other people. I'm incapable of having with other people. But once I do that, it sort of forces us all into a position where we have to have a conversation about it. And so I had these three conversations that were incredibly intimate, and where we were talking about things we'd never talked about. And I have a pretty close family. We're pretty forthcoming, but there are still things that we don't talk about because it's painful. But having those conversations, as hard as it was, it brought us closer together.
Given the potential for hurting people close mm-hmm. to you, is it still worth it to write these essays?
Absolutely. I have no regrets about anything I've written, because I have I don't think I've ever written an essay or a personal story that didn't feel entirely urgent for me to tell. And by urgent, I mean there was a question, some scorching question inside of me that I needed to answer. And the only way I could do that was by writing about it. That is the only way I know how to answer my own deep questions. And I think, you know, like most people, I am conflict averse. I am not interested in being provocative for its own sake. But I am interested in finding insights from my own struggles, right? And I am also interested in sharing stories that will be of service to other people out in the world. And so I think this process of naming things that people don't often talk about or that people are afraid to talk about is incredibly powerful. And it was books like that that really helped me through my own difficult early years and adolescence. And, you know, stories like my own kept me company through the hardest parts of my own life.
So all of that is a great precursor to talking about some of the stories you tell. So let's go back. Mm-hmm. Your father was a sea captain. Mm-hmm. Your birth father was, or your natural father, was John. Mm-hmm. He abandoned the family, right? Mm-hmm. And you were really raised by the sea captain.
Yeah, it's it can be complicated because when I say my father or my dad, I always mean the sea captain. Yeah. That's my dad. I have no childhood memory of my birth father. And, you know, my mother actually left him when I was still an infant. But I do think that, you know, he was an active alcoholic and addict. And that itself is a kind of abandonment, both of other people and of oneself, you know. So, I look similar to my adoptive father. And so there were times in my childhood when I would forget. You know, I was told as a very young kid that I had this biological father, but that he basically didn't have anything to do with us. And he didn't. And so, you know, I had this sort of unique situation where there was this other person sort of out in the ether of my consciousness. But I had a family, and I had a father who was sort of performing that job and who I loved very deeply. And I never really interrogated that until I was 32.
The sea captain really was a sea captain.
Yes,
you were living at Cape Cod, and he went out to sea, which you say something really interesting. You say that when he was at home, he sometimes woke up screaming in the middle of the night because he had nightmares. And when he wasn't at home, you and your brother were the ones who woke up from nightmares in which terrible things had happened to him. And you tell us you became a sleepwalker in dealing with, I guess, to some extent, a response to the fact that he had abandoned you for a period of time again.
That's right. You know, and this is one of the kind of central themes of the book, I think, is the way that emotional legacies get passed down to us through our families and through our parents. And, you know, my father, the captain, would wake screaming from nightmares that I interpret as a result of his own very troubled and violent childhood. His father was an alcoholic and physically abusive to his mother and my father and his brothers. And that was something that haunted him my whole life and still does. And so that was something I understood at a very young age. And, you know, this feels delicate to talk about, but for us, for my brother and I, we were incredibly privileged to be raised by our parents who were never laid a hand on us and never drank. But my father was often leaving. And I think for a young child, it wasn't, you know, there was no Skype, there were no cell phones, there was no email. Like when he was gone, he would be gone. It was like he was dead, you know? And for us, that was sort of this primary wound that infiltrated our consciousness in a way that I do see as kind of parallel to my father's dreams. You know, it was this incomprehensible sadness or sorrow that our psyches were constantly trying to make sense of. And, you know,
I smiled when I read your father's favorite book and the story that he read to you.
Ferdinand.
The story of Ferdinand. Remind people about Ferdinand the Bull, who he was, and why was that story so important to him and to you?
Sure. That story, Ferdinand the Bull, is about a little bull who's very peaceful, and he wants to just lie in the grass and smell the flowers. And the men from Madrid come to take him to the ring, to the bullfighting ring, and they want him to fight the matador. You know, the story takes place in Spain. And, you know, Ferdinand is a pacifist. He doesn't want to fight, you know, and he refuses to fight. And ultimately he is freed from the bondage of that life because he stays true to who he is, right? And I think that story was a kind of parable for my father, because he grew up in this incredibly violent household, but he is essentially a very peaceful, kind person, you know? And, you know, he made a vow when he was really young that he was not going to repeat the mistakes of his father, as I think many people do, and most, at least to some significant degree, fail. You know, many people repeat the mistakes of their parents, often in their own parenting. And my father didn't. He never drank. He was not violent. He was a kind and gentle and loving father. And for that, I'm incredibly grateful. And so I think the story sort of parallels his own in that he stayed true to his nature, and he was rewarded by having sort of a life that he loved. You know, he followed his dream. And I think in some ways that's why it was so painful. My work in some ways has been very painful for him, because I'm naming these ways in which I have been hurt, or ways that I have made choices that hurt me. And I think for him as a father, he defined success as raising sort of happy and healthy and fulfilled children. He sort of defined successful fatherhood by his ability to protect us from ever being hurt. And I write books that are all about being hurt, you know, and sort of the alchemy of healing and transformation. And so they have happy endings, but they don't have happy middles. And I think that's been really hard for him to digest, particularly because of his own childhood.
We're going to take a break right now. When we come back, more with Melissa Phoebos, author of Abandon Me, a memoir.
Them that's got shall get, them that's not shall lose. So the Bible said, and it still is news. Mama may have, Papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own, that's got his own. Yes, the strong gets more, while the weak ones fade. Empty pockets don't ever make the grave. Mama may have, Papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own, that's got his own.
Welcome back to Two-Way Street. If you're just joining us, my guest is Melissa Phoebos. We're talking about her new book, Abandon Me, Memoirs. It's a searingly candid account of her most vulnerable fears and desires. Melissa is a creative writing teacher at Monmouth University. As we pick up, I asked her about her particular interest in the work of the Austrian poet and novelist Rainer Maria Rilke, who she cites several times in her book. The one writer who seems to be a dominant force for you is Rilke, yes? Mm-hmm. You said this, I think, in an interview, so correct me if I'm wrong. His Letters to a Young Poet was really important for me. I still teach it all the time. Mm-hmm. He has this line, "Ask yourself, would you cease to live if you could not write?" And when I first read it, I said yes, because I was 15 and everything felt like my life depended on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually taught from that book just last week in one of my classes. And, you know, I think I appreciate Rilke because of that quality. You know, when he wrote Letters to a Young Poet, he was in his early 30s, which is the time when I started living the events that Abandon Me concerns. And it is dramatic, and it is sort of, I don't know, it's intense. You know, he talks about writing, but he also just talks about living and loneliness and sadness and nature and love in a way that has high stakes, you know? And I think one of the messages of that book, which is really just a collection of his letters with an aspiring young poet, is do it all the way, you know? Like, if you're gonna do the thing you love all the way and go into every emotional phenomenon that enters you in the fullest way, like welcome the great breadth of human experience, both in the living, in relationships, in emotionality, intellectually, just give yourself to it, you know? And I think that point of view really sort of speaks to my own, you know, and this idea of abandonment, you know, if I can sort of state my mission or like the wisdom that I have gleaned from the experiences in this book, it is that I want to override my own fear of abandonment so that I am able to abandon myself to my own experience, to my own heart, and even if the cost of that is being hurt.
When you first introduce him as an important writer in your life, you write a sentence that I think, for me, is the theme that pervades this entire book. Maybe every desire is the desire to give ourselves away to some perfect keeper, to be known perfectly as only a creator could know us. So that line, and many that are similar, said to me, there's a hole in your heart that you have found so difficult to fill. Is that a fair characterization? And do you think you're unique in that way? Or are you teaching us about all of us?
I do think that is true. And I do not think that I am unique in this. I think we all have holes in our hearts. And I think that we're all looking for the things that will fill them, you know? And I think we often look to our lovers for those. But I never think... I don't think that the holes in our hearts are in the shape of our lovers, you know? And this is something I come back to again and again in the book. And if I were to pick a line that sort of sums up the meaning of it, that might be the one that I would also pick, because so much of this book and really all of the things I write are about that grasping and that chasing and that looking for a perfect kind of security or a perfect way of being known. And I think we crave this. I think probably all of us crave this. And what differs between us are the ways that we try to fill that, right? Or what we try to put into that heart hole. And for me, it has been lovers. It has been drugs. It has been stories. It has been my own writing. And in some ways, these succeed, but ultimately, I don't think they ever really do. And I sort of propose that maybe some idea, and I use this word very broadly, some conception of God might be the thing that can fit in that hole. But whatever you want to call it, for me, and I think for many of us, I think it is only something that we can give ourselves. It's not something that another person can ever give us.
You tell us that from an early age, being marked, physically marked, was important to you. Especially when it came to lovers. And I suppose if you're struggling with understanding who you are, when you have a hole in your heart, having a physical manifestation of someone's impact on you matters. So you start by telling us about hickeys.
That's right. I do. And I think, you know, that's a very astute observation. And I think it's true for me in many ways. And in this book, I describe many of the ways that desire has manifested. And I think in some ways, the book itself is a manifestation of my desire to concretize the metaphysical or the emotional or to make material the things that exist only inside of me, right? And you know, for hickeys, I think I describe that preference, which not everyone has, but as a kind of proof that I'm looking for, that I am wanted, that I am loved, that I have experienced intimacy with another person. I sort of find my scars just from, you know, I'm very clumsy and so I have many scars. But even as a kid, I sort of treasured my own scars just from being a rough and tumble type of kid, because it felt in a way like they anchored me in my body, in my human experience. They were proof that I was taking up space, I was existing, I had lived through things. And there was a kind of comfort to that, you know. And there's another essay in Abandon Me about all my tattoos, which you can now see, which I think function in a similar way. They were a way of marking myself permanently, of proving that I had learned something. You know, most of my tattoos signify sort of things that I've learned.
Yeah, I was looking forward to seeing your tattoos, and now I do. Let's talk about some of them.
Sure.
First of all, let's talk about the most recent one. Mm-hmm. I think you just had a tattoo. It's not in the book. It's more recent than the book. You just had a tattoo of a sentence from, what, Ann Dillard?
Annie Dillard, that's right. Yeah, this is a line in an essay of hers that I first read, I think, when I was a graduate student, and that I have since taught in nearly every class I've ever taught. And it's just one of those lines, you know, I don't know if you've ever had this experience, Bill, but when something that is just indelibly true sort of enters my consciousness at the right moment, it just imprints itself on me, you know. And this could be a thing that a person says or something that I read. And this line is one of those. And the line is, yielding at every moment to the perfect freedom of a single necessity. And she's in the essay, she's talking about the nature of weasels or animal nature. But really, in a larger human context, she's talking about devotion and of sort of, she's talking about abandoning yourself to the thing that you choose, to the thing that you prioritize over every other thing. And she's not naming what that should be, but just that spoke to me so much when I first read it. I think because that is the way that I aspire, like Rilke speaks about in Letters to a Young Poet, to sort of give myself to the things that I care about, to give myself to my practice of making art and writing, to give myself to love in a complete way, to yield at every moment to the perfect freedom of any one of those single necessities.
But you've known that essay and that line for quite some time.
I have.
But you just decided, I think within the last month, to actually have a tattoo. Where is that tattoo?
It's on my shoulders. It's okay. On the back of my shoulder.
Okay. Yeah. We'll take some pictures, if that's okay with
sure,
you.
Sure, yeah.
And share them on our website. Why did you suddenly decide it was time to put that sentence on your shoulders?
You know, that's a really good question. And I don't know if I've actually articulated this even to myself, but you know, I think all of my tattoos, you know, I get them sort of as after I've learned something or lived through something, and it feels like I'm marking a pause in my life where I want to absorb some truth about my own experience that I suspect I will need to remember for the rest of my life. And you know, it makes sense to me that I got this tattoo right before this book came out, because this book was not an easy one to write. The experiences that I cover in it were not easy to live through. And I think I was scared. I was sort of gathering my courage to step out into the world. I was in that moment between having written the story and put words to that very painful experience, and I was about to go public with it. I was about to be speaking about it with other humans. And I think it makes sense that I wanted to mark that moment with a permanent reminder that I believe in yielding in every moment to the perfect freedom of that necessity. Because, you know, this thing that I do, putting these incredibly personal stories out into the world, is there's so much freedom in it, but it is also very scary.
How long have you been promoting this book at this point?
It's only been out in the world for about 6 weeks.
Okay, but the point is, you've done lots of interviews.
Oh yeah, I've done many, many interviews. Yeah,
but you still seem to be emotional. It seems like you're fighting emotion as you talk about it with me, and I'm probably the 30th person who's interviewed you in the last week.
It's true. I mean, I think that is, I don't know, you know, and I, in some ways, like, it makes me happy to hear you say that, because my nature, my sort of initial survival mechanisms were to exile or repress my vulnerable feelings and to be like impervious to emotion and just super self-sufficient and never reveal anything. And what this practice of writing about my own experience has done is that it has softened me so much. And I think that's the point. That's what it is the thing I most fear, and it is the thing I most crave.
So in an effort to say something that our listeners can take, should we all be trying to do what you've done? Not necessarily writing a book.
Right.
But are you asking us that we consider delving into our deepest, deepest fears, our deepest practices that are destructive in some way, and try to find a way to purge them?
Absolutely. There's nothing that I recommend more highly than doing that. It is very, very painful. It is not, and it's not always the right time to do that. But when it is the right time, I don't think there's anything more worth our time.
So let's. I want to talk about your tattoos just a little more. Billie Holiday. Where's Billie Holiday on your?
Billie Holiday is here on my right
on your left
bicep. My left bicep.
And why Billie Holiday, and why that image of Billie Holiday? It's based on a photograph.
Right. It's based on a photograph that was in Downbeat magazine. You know, when I was an adolescent, this was before I learned to be publicly soft and articulate my feelings. But I was a very deeply thinking and deeply feeling young person. And I didn't know how to express that. I felt really vulnerable. I felt really overwhelmed a lot of the time. And I didn't know how to express it. And so a lot of the ways that I learned to sort of get in touch with my own feelings were through books and music. And I had a real sort of penchant for kind of dramatic books and music or art that expressed the feelings that I recognized that I could not express myself. And Billie Holiday was one of these. So I loved her music. It was just beautiful and tormented, and I identified with the way that it sounded. You know, it helped me feel my feelings in what felt like a contained way. And so I listened to her music a lot, and as a result of loving her music, I took singing lessons for a few years in my teens, and I never wanted to be a professional singer. I think in some way I wanted to be able to express what I heard in her music and what I felt inside of me, and I heard her do it, so I thought maybe I could do that too. And then when I got older, when I was in college and I was a heroin addict, and it was a really dark time in my life, I had this poster of this photograph, this famous photograph where she has her head tilted back and you can see her jawline and her mouth is open, and it's beautiful and it's vulnerable and it's kind of strong and it just feels open, you know, like she's exposing something of herself through her art, right? And I felt so isolated and alone and in so much pain that I just craved that ability to sort of ask for help or find a way to turn my suffering into art. And so then after I got clean, pretty soon after I got clean, I got a tattoo of that photograph because as sort of a commitment to finding my own way.
Well,
there.
And again, to mark the end of a period.
Exactly.
You tell us that in fifth grade, your best friend was Amelia. Mm-hmm. So Amelia made marks on you, but you say, I've always wanted to carve my name into the things I was afraid of losing. So
That's
you
right.
have an impulse to make marks yourself.
That's right.
And the reason I mention that now is I wonder how much that came into play when you became a dominatrix for, what, 4 years at a dungeon in New York?
That's right. You know, I think it had a lot to do with it. You know, being a dominatrix sounds sort of a loud subject, you know? It sounds like so far outside of our culture and what's generally accepted. But I really see it as part of this progression of my heeding my impulse to explore and enact the parts of me that I keep secret or that it feels like there's not a place in our culture or in my life for. And in writing I do this, and as a dominatrix I did this as well, where I literally assumed this sort of alter identity and acted out these characteristics that I never did in my normal life that included, you know, physical violence and cruelty or aspects of femininity or expressed femininity that I didn't feel comfortable with in my
everyday
life.
What does a dominatrix do? What did you do?
A dominatrix dresses up in various costumes and acts out the fantasies of her clients. So technically it's classified as a sex work job, although there's no actual sex that takes place. I would play basically every iconic, powerful female role that is recognized by our culture. I played mother characters a lot. I played sort of the known dominatrix character with the whip and the leather boots and fishnets. Or I would play a school teacher, which is ironic as I'm now a college professor, or a customs officer one time. But I would enact these scenarios with my clients who were always men from sort of all walks of life, a lot of sort of high-powered businessman types. And I would enact these hour-long scenes with them at this dungeon, which was this sprawling sort of space in Midtown Manhattan. And oftentimes I would be reenacting their own childhood traumas.
When you do that job, you're focusing on what the client, what the customer wants, which doesn't give you a whole lot of time to think about whether that hole in your heart is being filled in any way. And more important, you get to control it completely. Mm-hmm. I would think that is a temporary but ultimately not successful way to deal with the longing that you found yourself having throughout your life.
I think that's exactly right. And my years as a dominatrix, I don't now see as an attempt to fill that hole, but to cover it up.
Right.
It was like I wanted to throw a tarp over it.
Right.
And I thought, okay, if I am playing this empowered role and I'm engaged in these, like, you know, not sex, but erotic scenarios where I'm not feeling the desire, it was almost like I was practicing being a person
that never turned you on.
I'm not going to say it never turned me on, but they were not my fantasies. You know, it sort of psychologically turned me on to be the person in the scenario who was not begging, who was not desirous, who was in control. And I thought, this is how a person who didn't have a hole in their heart, who wasn't racked by longing, this is how they would act. And maybe this is how I can become that person who's never vulnerable.
Let's take another break. We'll continue our conversation with Melissa Phoebos in just a minute. Welcome back to Two-Way Street. Let's continue now with my conversation with author Melissa Phoebos, author of Abandon Me Memoirs. A number of the essays in this book deal with your long-term relationship with Amaya, is that how she says her name? Which was a painful, painful, and a somewhat self-destructive relationship.
Yes. I think the term self-destructive is interesting because it's one that I've used and that has been used to describe many of my personal choices.
You were in a very vulnerable and at times powerless position in that relationship. Tell us just a little bit about what that relationship was and why it occupies so much of this book.
Sure. I think in many ways that relationship was, I don't know, God or the universe or probably my own psyche sort of calling my hand. After years of being in control and being totally self-sufficient, and no one had ever even broken up with me. And not because I'm so perfect, but because I wasn't interested in taking that risk. I wasn't interested in entering into relationships where I was in touch with my deepest longing or my own neediness or any kind of desperation or that profound a vulnerability. And in this relationship, I met this I met this married woman and got into this very intense long-distance relationship where almost immediately everything I knew about how I operated in relationships was obsolete. I was desperate. I was obsessed. I was begging. I was incredibly vulnerable. I cried every day for 2 years.
You left a partner
I
to
did.
Be with her.
I did.
Making
you
even more vulnerable.
Yeah, I did. It consumed my life for 2 years. And, you know, it was almost as though I was making up for lost time, you know, or maybe sometimes I think about my psyche as sort of devising, all right, we're going to get this over with and we're going to do it as quickly as possible. So it's just going to be like boot camp of vulnerability and relationships, you know, because it was unlike anything I'd ever experienced. And I had always feared being in this position in a relationship. And I had always feared how painful it would be. And most things that we fear for a long time are not as bad as we fear. And this actually was. It was actually as painful as I had feared all my life, you know, and I have no regrets about it now. But it was the most difficult 2 years of my life.
Many people have been in relationships that are crazy in that way.
Mm-hmm.
It's not an uncommon thing to have happen. And the question becomes whether you've ever figured out, is that love or is that obsession? And is there a difference between the two?
I do think there's a difference between the two. And, you know, love is a very plastic term. You can apply it to many
sure.
things. But in this case, I think it has much more to do with that hungry hole in your heart. I mean, my definition of love, of true love, of the kind of love I aspire to in an intimate relationship is not marked by obsession. It's marked by generosity, which I think is actually the opposite. When you're afraid and you're desperate, it's an incredibly self-centered place to be. You know, you're in a fight or flight survival mode, and you will collapse or step on many things you care about to get the thing you think you need.
Well, right? You also tell us, really, that it's really difficult in a relationship like that to truly love. You say mm-hmm. it's hard to care rightly for someone you fear losing. It becomes possible also to hate them.
It's true. It's true. When you are constantly wanting more from someone and not getting what you feel you need, it can be easy to generate resentment. You know, and I think that does happen. And, you know, if I learned anything from that experience, it's that I need to fill the hole in my heart, right? And once I do so, I'm sated. I'm not starving, emotionally starving anymore. And then I can actually give to the people I love. I can choose them freely without desperation, and I can give to them instead of always needing and wanting.
Yeah. She betrayed you.
Yeah.
You tell a very painful story about
mm-hmm.
Opening up her computer
mm-hmm.
and finding notes that she'd written to another woman.
That's right. That's right. That was the only time that I'd ever experienced that, although I'd been on the other end of it a couple times. I mean, not least notably at the beginning of my relationship
with
Maya.
Yeah, the woman you left to be with her.
Yeah, it was sort of like our beginning was reversed and enacted upon me by the end. And I mean, what I can say about that is that I will never put another person through that again. You know, I would also like to say that as much as I think there were a lot of mutual betrayals in that relationship, and that was the one time I've ever been that I know of betrayed in that particular way. But the betrayal that stands out most for me in that relationship was the ways that I betrayed myself, the ways that I compromised who I am and what I love in service to that sort of desperation.
So I want to go back to your writing for a couple minutes.
Mm-hmm.
In Whip Smart, you told us about your work as a dominatrix.
Mm-hmm.
You told us that you were a heroin addict.
Mm-hmm.
So at a certain point, I can't help but wonder, what have you revealed in this book that is so terribly painful that we haven't already learned about you?
Right. I mean, you know, when I published Whip Smart, I remember explicitly thinking, whew, well, at least I'll never have to write anything that personal again. And I think my understanding of what was personal has evolved, right? Because on the surface, heroin addiction and sex work are very personal, but they're personal by the measure of other people's perception, right? Like, those are things that people disapprove of, that are shocking to other people. But what is personal, you know, what is vulnerable to me is much more sort of the things that I fear exposing, you know, the things that I keep buried deep inside of me. And, you know, as we've already talked about, those things are much more sort of my own longings, my own vulnerabilities, my own desperation. To expose my desperation in love feels much, much more personal and vulnerable to me than talking about how I used to shoot heroin.
Yeah, we don't want to let people know who we are.
Yeah, my powerless, and even I think there's more of sort of a cultural story, like being powerless over heroin is something that people understand, even if they judge it. But being powerless in love, being powerless to other people, it feels much deeper to me, you know? And I think just in terms of my own sort of early value system, I thought that is a thing I will never do. You know, there's even a way that in our culture, I think there's a story about sort of a dominatrix or a heroin addict where it's kind of tough. I mean, ultimately, it's not, as I write about. But for being sort of desperate in a relationship, for begging for something from your lover or crying every, there's nothing cool or tough, or there's no way to spin that so that it's anything but incredibly vulnerable and pitiable in some ways.
You tell a story about Frank Baum that I really think is great.
Mm-hmm.
The Emerald City. Mm-hmm. First of all, you tell us a story about how Baum himself had nightmares about a scarecrow chasing him.
That
led him toward writing The Wizard of Oz.
Mm-hmm.
But you talk to us about how he was, his notion of the people of the Emerald City wearing green glasses. Tell us how that story mattered to you.
Oh, I was so happy when I stumbled upon that, you know. And I do think it's important that his work, the Wonderful Wizard of Oz, came out of his own deepest fears, and he sort of turned them into this magical world and sort of defanged them in his own work. And, you know, in the book, the people of the Emerald City wear these green goggles. The Emerald City is not an Emerald City. It's just a regular city. It's not even necessarily a nice place. But they wear these green goggles that make it look beautiful to them. And so they are all sort of colluding in this delusion that they live in this magical place. And that just made so much sense to me, particularly in the context of this book and the relationship that I describe in it, because, and I think we all do this in love, we sort of collude in this fantasy of our relationship. We create this mythology in love about how we were fated to be together, and there's never been any love like this before. And in many ways, it's a fantasy. And I think particularly in the relationship that I describe in the book, it was a pronounced experience where it was so painful. And there were such problematic aspects to it that I was even more reliant on the mythology of the relationship than I had ever been before. And, you know, the process of writing this book and of ending that relationship was really kind of like me taking my green goggles off so that I could look at the truth, which would be disappointing, but was also reality.
Life seems so complicated for you, Melissa.
You know, I wouldn't actually describe it as complicated. I would say that it has been intense, right? But if those intense experiences have taught me anything, it is that there are simple ways to go about living. There are not easy ways to avoid pain in life, but that doesn't preclude simplicity.
So as we finish, how's your heart these days?
My heart is so good, Bill. My heart feels really full, you know? I mean, I learned so much from writing this book, and I learned so much from those very painful experiences. And, I don't, you know, I'm in love again. And I took a big, long break after all of that. And just to sort of absorb what I had learned and to think about how I wanted to be different, you know, how I wanted to integrate those lessons into my own life. And now I feel like I'm doing that, and it is not tormented. It doesn't feel complicated. I don't feel like the hole in my heart is starving anymore. I feel like I have a lot more to give now.
That's great. The book is Abandon Me, Melissa Phoebos' memoirs. It's really been a pleasure to have you here. And thank you not only for writing a book in which you open yourself up so completely to us, but the fact that you were willing to do that as we sat for this conversation. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you'd like to learn more about Melissa Phoebos, we've got information on the Two-Way Street website at gpb.org/TWS. We've posted a link to her website, and you can learn more about her book, Abandon Me. We've also posted the TED Talk that she gave last year when she talked about how difficult it is to reveal yourself in a memoir. We're just about out of time for this week's show. Remember, if you can't listen when we're on the radio, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. We also archive all of our shows on our website. And you can follow us on Facebook. Our senior producer is the juvenescently gelogenic Jenny Amond. Our producer is the jauntily jocund Lisa Clark. Our engineer is the jarringly jazzy Tyler Morris. I'm Bill Nygut. Thanks for listening. I hope to see you again next week for another Two-Way Street.